So thank you so much, everyone, for coming out today. I just want to give a special thanks to Zeifman's, who hosts our classes every year. It's really great to come. And also to the Bayit and Shari Shemayim for partnering with us to make these series of Shirim happen. Just a note before we begin that, of course, if we're taking this for credit, we want to make sure that everyone who's here gets the credit that they deserve. So particularly if your Zoom name doesn't reflect your real name, if you have some kind of alias, or if you're not on this email list, please make sure to sign into the chat just with your name and email address, just to make sure that they'll give you credit and there won't be any questions about that. So the topic I want to explore, and I'll just share my screen so that I attach the file in the chat, but also share my screen here. Right, I see some just to be sure. So yeah, with signing in, I would say better safe than sorry. If there's any doubt, can't hurt to sign in just to make sure that we know you're here. Okay, also, I'll try to check the chat periodically during the shiur, but I might not be able to so frequently. But certainly, if anyone has any questions or comments, feel free to unmute yourself and chime in, and participation is definitely welcome. So the topic I want to discuss today is, call it the selfish citizen, the ethics of aggressive tax avoidance. Now, tax avoidance is an interesting term because, you know, to one extent or another, I think we all want to avoid overpaying in taxes. So there are just some people coming in from the waiting room. All right. Yeah, I think we all want to avoid overpaying in taxes. And in general, I think people don't love shelling out a whole chunk of their money to the government. And consequently, when the law permits, people will try to use legal, or sometimes not so legal, methods of reducing how much they pay. In fact, this led author Lawrence Peter, quoted here, to say that few of us ever use test our powers of deduction except when filling out an income tax return. So we definitely want to, and we want to get the most bang for our buck when paying taxes, to get as much of our own income that we worked for as we can. And therefore we hire accountants like many of the accountants here to help us do our taxes in a way that's beneficial to us. And I think there's often a feeling that taxes are oppressive, and we resent the government reaching into our pockets. I thought this was best expressed by the Beatles in the 1966 song Taxman, if anyone remembers that, which was actually written in response to the higher level of progressive tax which was imposed by the Labour government under Harold Wilson in Britain. And at the time, they instituted a super tax for the highest earners, where they actually have to pay 95% of their income to the government, which led George Harrison and Taxman to say, there's one for you, 19 for me. But the Taxman took 95% of their income. And George Harrison said that he wrote this song when he first started earning money, and he realized he was giving most of it away in taxes. And because of these exorbitant tax rates, at that time, many wealthy people from Britain were known to keep separate accounts in the Bahamas and the like in order to avoid paying these exorbitant taxes. In fact, Ringo Starr reported that the group did actually go for a scheme where they paid someone to live in the Bahamas and hold their money. And he said it turns out they ended up paying the taxes anyway. But we see that when tax rates are very high, so people will go to great measures to avoid paying taxes. And the question I want to look at is, when is that legitimate? When is it just part of basically an accountant's job? And when does it cross the line into what the CRA terms as aggressive tax avoidance? So first, from a Jewish law perspective, I want to explore two things. One, does Jewish law view levying taxes by a secular government to be legitimate? And if so, on what grounds and for what purposes? And two, with regard to the idea of tax avoidance, how does Jewish law view using legal means to avoid expenses that it might have otherwise incurred? I mean, there's a legal loophole to get out of something, there's a legal method, but if not for that loophole, I would have incurred some sort of penalty. So how does Jewish law view that? And as we get to that, I'll illustrate more what that means. So first, from a Jewish law perspective, does the government have a right to take my hard-earned money? Right, I worked for it. So does the government have to have a right to take it? Now, just to clarify, we are aware in the Torah of different tithes of Truma and Maser, tithes that were given to the priests, to the Levites, and that were contributed to other community expenses. But what about in just general, a king or a ruler or government levying taxes? What does Jewish law have to say about that? Any ideas?
How can they say no if we need to fund government libraries, the military, schools, collecting your garbage? That's just being part of a citizen.
Excellent point. That's an excellent point. So there was someone who said, I hate paying taxes, but I love what they give me. And I think it's very much on that point that the infrastructure and all the resources we have has to come from somewhere. They don't pay for themselves. So what you're saying is that just on a practical level, if the government wants to provide anything, so they need to come up with the funds to do so.
Like the half shekel for the Bet Hakavai to restore the Beit HaMikdash. It's the same sort of idea.
Right. That's one example that's specifically described in the Torah, but extrapolating from that when a society needs to run and a population needs certain resources, so just logically, it would make sense that a government would be allowed to levy taxes. What about if the taxes are not necessarily used, at least exclusively, for bettering the lives of its citizens, providing them with more resources, but is to enrich the monarch? You know, back in the day where there was a king or an absolute monarch, and the king had to get his wealth from somewhere. So what do you think Jewish law says about paying taxes that are meant to enrich the ruling monarch?
Isn't it Dina de Malchuta?
Dina de Malchuta, right. So you wrote the principle. So if those aren't familiar, Dina de Malchuta, Dina, so it's an expression that we'll actually see shortly, and that means that the law of the kingdom is the law. That, of course, under Torah law, we have certain of our own laws, but there's a discussion about the scope of that law, but actually, at least with regard to paying taxes, there's an idea that if the Torah doesn't say I have to pay taxes, you know, to the CRA per se, but if it's the law in Canada that I have to pay taxes, so the principle of Dina de Malchuta, that the law of the kingdom is the law, would require me to do so. So let's see this next source, because it is true that we have a concept of Dina de Malchuta, but the Talmud itself notes exceptions to this. What might an exception be?
Well, I was wondering, before you go on about Miami, with respect to a Beatles song, I guess the taxes have to be fair and reasonable. And then when they're 95%, maybe that's not considered fair and reasonable.
So what would we, where would we draw the line at fair and reasonable?
I guess that becomes a bit of a quandary as to where to draw the line. But I think there is a line.
Right. Right, I do see, and I hear the, you can hear it instinctively that at a certain point a tax becomes oppressive, meaning if the whole idea, or one of the ideas of taxes are supposed to provide for the population, and then the population isn't able to survive because they're taxed so heavily, there could be, it would make sense to say that at a certain point it's extortion and that it's oppressive. But as far as, so the... Right, and it depends on the needs and on the society.
Every country, there's different taxes in every country, different amounts. I mean, there was a time when in the UK they were charging taxes at 70%, whereas everybody else was charging 30 or 40%. So it depends on the needs to a consumer when they did that. So, and we're living in the Western world, at least, hopefully, we're living in a different kind of environment. Trusting government, we have some trusting government, and if they say that it's got to be 90%, for whatever reason, we've got to trust that they do, and especially in an open society as we're living in today.
Right, so a lot of these things are just even thinking of how they're spent and what the needs are, there could be many variables to consider. From some of the things we mentioned, at first glance it seems to be more complicated, because at first glance, we'll take a look at source 3, the rabbis of the Talmud seem to view tax collection as robbery. And what's the consequence of that? Is if money is taken illegally, so others aren't allowed to benefit from that money. So the Mishnah in source 3 says that one may not make change using money from the tax collector's box, because the assumption here, and the Talmud explains, that there were tax collectors who were either self-appointed or who may have been appointed but had no limit on how much they were able to take. I mean, the king said, report back to me with such and such amount, but the tax collector had the right to then take more. So there was reason to suspect that if you were making change with a particular tax collector from his fund, that it contained stolen funds. So the Mishnah tells us not to do that. And then the Talmud asks, well, what about dina d'malchuta dina? The idea that the law of the kingdom is the law. So it says that in a society where the funds were obtained illegally through theft, then it would still be forbidden to use those funds, because it would be considered stealing, even if officially, the king allowed the tax collectors to just take as they wished. However, if the tax collectors were not just free to take whatever they want, but were appointed by the king and were told, let's say, to take 20%, maybe even 50-60%, and that was the tax rate that the king set, so then you would be obligated to pay it. If you look at source 4, the Rambam, Maimonides, says this. He says, in contrast to the case that we saw in our mission in source 3, the Rambam says, if, however, the customs collector was appointed by the king to take, whether it's a third, a fourth, or any fixed amount of the subject's goods or their values, The custom collector appoints a Jew to take this sum for the king. A Jew were considered generally would be more trustworthy in this. Or if it's known that this person is faithful, does not add anything beyond what the king decreed. The king says 20%. The person takes 20%. So this person is not considered a robber. So that we're not concerned about exchanging and taking what's in his box, because we don't assume that it's stolen. And this applies whether the king is Jewish or non-Jewish. So it says if a king levies taxes, he has a certain rate, and he sends collectors to collect at that rate, they have to report back to him. So in that case, tax collection is not considered theft, and the people are obligated to pay. Beyond just money, the Rambam continues in source 5, he says that a king can also confiscate private property for community use. So he says that when a king cuts down trees belonging to private people and uses them for a bridge, one is permitted to cross it. Similarly, if he destroys homes in order to construct a road or a wall, he is permitted to benefit from it. And the same principle applies in all analogous situations because the laws of a king are binding. And it sounds like you have nice firewood in your backyard. The king says, he comes to your house, he says, wow, this would work really nicely for a bridge. So according to this, the king would be allowed to take that, or messengers of the king would be allowed to take your property and could use it to fund public services, and it wouldn't be considered stolen property. So there was someone who had their hand raised. Right, so I think it depends what they're authorized to do. I mean, I think here the distinction is if they actually have authorization by the king, they're not just these bandits running around. And two, if they have to, you know, basically report back with a receipt, they have to say how much the king says collect 20%, then they have to report back with 20%. They're not allowed to. The king doesn't say go collect as you will, just bring me back something. So I think when it's controlled, when they're authorized and when they're not allowed to take an unlimited amount, then that's considered a legitimate employee of the government, and the government is allowed to collect those funds. Right. I mean, I think this is not necessarily, I think when we see that the distinction is made between tax collectors who take illegally as opposed to an organized system of taxes, so it seems here we're really worried about taking taxes in a manner that's unrestrained. But as far as tax rates, so I think we have to be, you know, we have to be responsible about it. But I don't see here, at least, that there's that the hesitance or what the concern is really on tax rates as opposed to inconsistent rates. You know, for example, the Rambam here said that if he said that the customs collector in the Source 4 was appointed by the king to take a third, a fourth, or any fixed amount of the subject's goods for their value. So even by saying by any fixed amount, it seems like the government can set a policy that this is a tax rate, and if so, the people have to pay it. And we saw not only that, a person is actually a king or his messengers are allowed to take people's property to be used to fund the public good, and included, as we said, bridges, roads, etc. And why is that? Why should it be? We understand on one hand, we want to fund public services and resources, but, you know, to say that you know, I'm in my backyard chopping wood, and then an officer of the king comes and says, oh, this would really be really nice to build a bridge. You know, hand over your wood. We're gonna build a bridge with this. Why should they have the right to do that? So, in Source 6, the Rambam and others understand that fundamentally, when a person lives in a place, so they've accepted the rule of the king. In fact, the Balei HaTosafos and the Ran, some of the other early commentators say that it's essentially rent. That I want to live in Canada, so I have to pay the government rent. And I don't like it, so I can leave. But I think what this is saying is, even if the taxes are for the purpose of enriching the king, we're still obligated to pay, because basically we're living in the king's house. You know, we want to live in a building. We pay what the landlord. We pay the rate that the landlord sets. Okay, maybe rent control, whatever. There could be some limits, but the basic idea is we're paying for the right. At least classically, the idea is we're paying for the right to live in a place, and therefore, even if the king says I want to levy an 80% tax or whatever it is, because I want to go on vacation or want to buy an extra horse. So seemingly that would be legitimate as long as it was. Set fairly, and his tax collectors weren't allowed to just take whatever they want. A king can even set a tax to enrich himself, because the subjects are considered to be paying for the right to live in the land. But there could be, as Nobel said, there could be an even stronger reason to justify modern systems of taxation. As in Rabbi Herschel Schechter points out in this article in Source 7, he says that it's important to note that the basis for taxation is totally different from what it was in Talmudic times. In Talmudic times, it basically was to fund the pocket of the king. But he says today, all modern countries provide a variety of services. They provide streets and highways and maintain forests and museums, provide fire, police, and military perspective, collect garbage and deliver mail. Okay, garbage is only every 2 weeks here, but, you know, and basically they provide certain services. And Schechter had, in his view, modern systems of taxation are not necessarily binding by the same reason as in Talmudic times, that you were basically paying for the right to live in a country. But here, he says that modern taxes are really in the category of a business partnership, called of shutvin. That basically all of the citizens living in used to be in a neighborhood, but maybe even in a country, are partners in contributing for the welfare and to the resources of that place. So he continues that the purpose behind taxes is no longer to enrich the king in the slightest. And he says that the government officials have to be paid, they have salaries, but you're not paying more, and it's not like the taxes are raised, then the prime minister gets a higher salary. And he says, therefore, in our modern world, one who does not pay his proper share of taxes is no longer viewed as cheating the king or the ruler of the country, but rather as cheating and really stealing from his partners. If we're all partners, and it's upon all of us to pay for the hospitals and pay for the roads, and one of the partners isn't paying, so then I'm viewed as stealing from the other partners, because what's going to happen? I don't pay. The hospital still needs to be built. So that will mean, when evaluating how much taxes to levy, so that the taxes will have to go up. It will force others to pay more. And therefore, it's even more than just this din of more than there's just this law of dina de malchuta dina. Just that if the king sets a law, you have to follow it. This is actually not paying taxes would be stealing from someone else. Because if I don't pay, then the burden is going to fall more heavily on the other citizens. Because essentially, we're paying for services that we use. Yep?
However, we may get into this later. The topic was tax avoidance as opposed to evasion.
All right.
The setting of avoidance is sometimes it's schemes or passageways that CRA sets up for people to use to pay less tax if they, you know, do what is instructed to be done. It's all legal, it's all above board, and it's a way of, sometimes it's a method to get people to invest in certain things or act in a certain way. So I'm not sure it falls into this category of going against what the government wants done with respect to, maybe it's the extreme avoidance term.
So that's what we'll see. That's part two. I just have it on the screen. We'll see the difference between evasion and avoidance, and then within avoidance, what qualifies as tax avoidance, and then see what cases in Torah law reflect this. Because as you said, right, the government granted that they levy taxes, but they also give tax breaks for certain things that they consider in their interests. So we'll see in what cases, at least how the CRA defines it, in what cases is it considered legitimate tax avoidance as opposed to aggressive tax avoidance. So we'll get there.
TSFA or is RSP or those sorts of schemes, are they considered tax avoidance because you're not paying tax because you're taking advantage of them?
Right. So that's what we'll see. We'll take a look at both the CRA guidelines and some examples in Torah law. So just one last point of this, until we get to the next part, is a gripe that sometimes people have with paying taxes is, you know, I don't need all of the things that taxes go to. You know, maybe I want roads and a hospital, but I don't care about sports stadiums, or I don't care about a new park or a new museum. I mean, I do, but let's say different people have different interests. Then, you know, probably most people who are paying taxes aren't going to use all of the services that their taxes go to, and if maybe it was up to them, they would do without the museum or the sports stadium. So can I say that on that basis there's any reason to not pay the taxes? So according to Rabbi Schechter's approach that this is all essentially a partnership, he cites from the laws governing partnerships that the residents of a town, this is reflected in source 8 in the Code of Jewish Law, saying that the residents of a town can force one another, and even the minority can force the majority, to put up a wall with gates and a bolt for a town, basically to fund resources, even if not everyone either wants or will take advantage of them. And the idea of taxes funding the common good is something that Professor Neil Brooks describes here. He says, at the most basic level, we have taxes because we have governments. Collecting taxes is simply one of the ways that government has to achieve its broad social and economic objectives. The efficient allocation of resources and thus the maximization of social welfare is a normative government objective that preoccupies economists. So I think this, you know, sums up modern systems of taxation. That even, we say even according to Jewish law, even if it was to enrich the government, that may even be legitimate. But certainly with modern taxes, the fact that they go to resources that benefit all of us, you know, certainly makes it obligatory to pay. Nevertheless, the government does provide ways to reduce the amount of taxes paid. And ostensibly, these allowances for tax avoidance are meant to support behavior that the government views as beneficial. So, for example, charities, religious organizations, family life, operations of businesses, you know, many other things, but these are all areas that the government will, to one extent or another, grant the tax break or tax exemption. And they do that even though the government, as we saw, needs money, they need to allow society to function. But because they want to support and encourage certain behaviors, so they, if an individual fits into one of the categories that the government wants to support, so they will that will reduce the taxes that individual would have to pay. So then we have the question, what's the difference between, well, it's a tax evasion, but tax avoidance, and in particular, and I should have noted this on here, aggressive tax avoidance. Meaning tax avoidance is essentially, I'm using the services that the government allows and maybe even wants, so, and that will reduce the amount of taxes I pay. But when does tax avoidance become aggressive? Just to contrast, tax evasion means I falsify records, it claims I hide incoming. I mean, that's for sure illegal. But avoidance is this kind of gray area. Some avoidance is encouraged. It's supposed to. The government wants to give tax breaks on this. But when does it become aggressive tax avoidance? Any ideas? Right, and there are laws about that. They say in a little bit below in the Income Tax Act. See, it does define what the difference is. So basically, the distinction seems to be, and of course there are many specifics, and probably all those specifics have to be judged on their own merits and their own factors. But the distinction that appears to be between sanctioned tax avoidance and aggressive tax avoidance is when a taxpayer minimized tax payable by contravening the objective and spirit but not the letter of the law. So with aggressive tax avoidance, the taxpayer doesn't provide false information but uses the provisions of tax legislation in a manner that was not intended by its drafters. And then the CRA has to make that determination. But like we said, the government wants to give tax benefits for certain type of behavior. So here, the person who's engaging in aggressive tax avoidance is using the law in the books in a way that the drafters of the law didn't intend. And in the Income Tax Act, Section 245, so it defines an avoidance transaction as basically a transaction exclusively for the purpose of avoiding taxes. In other words, if it were not for avoiding taxes, the transaction likely wouldn't have taken place. So, some popular examples of this are, these offshore accounts, having these offshore accounts with foundations, places like the Bahamas, and other places where the tax rates are lower. So, I open up the Alex Beck Foundation in the Bahamas, and okay, and then I it's a legitimate thing, but I'm only doing it because on the $5 billion I made last year, I didn't really make that. But so then I can funnel that into that account, and I guess technically, it may not violate a black letter law, but that would be an example where, again, the legality of doing that depends actually on in different countries there are different laws about that, but. But that's really would be an example of this, that I'm just using, I'm doing something that's only for the purpose of achieving a tax benefit. Another, I think, famous example where this was done was there was in 18th century Britain, there was something called the window tax. And the window tax taxed you based on how many windows your house had. And the idea, of course, was you assume that the larger a house, the more windows it had. So what would people do? They'd keep their house the same size, but they'd cover their windows. And that way they would get around the tax. So Robert Turchino actually sent me an email. I don't know who it's from, I'm not sure if they're here, but that when they heard the topic of tax avoidance, so this person said that when they were in England, they were told by a tour guide that they used to decrease the amount of windows in order to evade taxes. And then this person pointed out that this is not tax evasion, this is tax avoidance. And I think this, it illustrates this, but this might be an example of something. It's not like the builder of the house otherwise designed it in a way that it preferred less windows, but did a certain transaction or a certain action that was done for the exclusive purpose of avoiding a tax. And there are probably many, many specifics, but that's the basic, those are the basic guidelines that the CRA gives, is that it's that if it's a transaction that's done for the exclusive purpose of avoiding tax, and otherwise would not really have been carried out.
Rabbi?
Yes.
What about a situation where a corporation discovers that they can save a lot of tax simply by packing up and moving to another jurisdiction, which is a lower tax jurisdiction? I think everyone in society would consider this to be completely legitimate, but it's a transaction which is strictly for the purpose of paying less tax.
Right. I definitely hear that it's a gray area. I'm just looking at the CRA definition, and he says that the determination of what tax avoidance has occurred is made on a balance of probabilities. So I guess in each case, the government would have to determine whether it's something that would be considered a valid enough decision in of itself, even if the owners of the business, let's say in their mind, they only moved to place so and so because there was a lower tax rate, but. It seems to be that they would have to determine that. I can't say whether that case would be or not. As you said, it would seem to be legitimate, but I guess it would have to be determined to what extent a transaction would be considered to be done exclusively or solely for the purpose of avoiding taxes. So excellent point, and I thank you, because this is the next section, next topic I wanted to address, is the idea of, I think what Jerry actually said, is harama, sort of a legal fiction. And there are cases where each case, the factors are different, but to one extent or another, it seems like we're used technicalities of the law to accomplish something that maybe originally wasn't the full intent of the law. And he's mentioned at least some cases where that seems to be acceptable. So now let's take a look at in what cases we consider that type of, call it legal fiction, to be used, and in what cases we don't consider it acceptable. So, at least in the following place, it seems like the use of harama or deceit, or literally, is something that we don't consider acceptable, and we view very negatively. And Rabbi Richter Jr. actually mentioned this in a shiur about a similar topic a couple of years ago. He mentioned this point, and so I thank him very much for these resources. And mentioned the case of, and it occurred to me when I was thinking about it last night, very practical for this year, right? Shavuot is on Thursday night, and then we have Yom Tov going right into Shabbos. So what do we need to remember to do? What do we need to remember to make? Erev Tavshilin, right. This was a good reminder for me because I probably would have forgotten otherwise. So what's an Erev Tavshilin? So an Erev Tavshilin is basically allows you to cook from Yom Tov going into Shabbos. The basic law is that one is allowed to cook on Yom Tov for needs of the day, but isn't allowed to cook on Yom Tov for after Yom Tov or even second day Yom Tov. So what the rabbis allowed one to do is to make what's called an Erev Tavshilin, literally sort of a mixing of the foods, where one really begins the cooking process for Shabbos before Yom Tov. So this would be before Thursday night. I would start my cooking. I'd put a piece of bread or a piece of matzah, a baked item, a food item. And I have in mind that I'm continuing, that will be the beginning of my cooking for Shabbos. And then on Friday, I could then make other preparations for Shabbos. Like I could cook for what I'm not going to use on Friday, but for the next day, which if I didn't make that Erev Tavshilin before, I wouldn't be allowed to do. So what if someone ate the Erev Tavshilin? So the idea of the Erev Tavshilin is that the food is at least around when you're preparing. This is the start of your Shabbos preparation. But if I get really hungry on Friday morning before I've started to cook for Shabbos, and I eat my Erev Tavshilin, so then I have nothing left. Then it's not going to help me. So what does someone do in that situation? So the Talmud says one possibility is if someone ate the Erev or didn't make the Erev, so they can cook. Let's say on Friday morning, I don't have my lunch meal ready. So I can make a fairly large lunch. And then if I have leftovers, I can use that for Shabbos. Right? But essentially, the cooking that I did was for the day of Yom Tov. And if there's any more, I could use it for Shabbos. So that would be okay. But what's not okay is when someone performs what they call a haram. And that's not that I'm cooking for my Friday meal, but I'm also allowed to cook for Yom Tov if there's a possibility of guests coming over, which this year, for other reasons, would be especially hard to justify. So in theory, let's say I thought there may be 100 people coming to my house. So I've already eaten my day meal, but potentially I can cook a meal for 100 people on the possibility that they may come. But in this case, it's saying a person can't do that. A person can't say, I'm not really cooking for tomorrow. I'm just cooking now on the chance that 100 people come. But he knows full well he's not doing it for that reason. And especially this year, you're really not going to be able to justify that because no one's coming to your house, unfortunately. So he said, in that case, no, that would not be allowed. He wouldn't be able to eat it. And in fact, it says that the sages are more strict with, they call a haruma, with this deception than they are with an actual violation, meaning if someone didn't actually make the Erev Tavshilin altogether. Why would they be stricter with this deception or this trickery as opposed to an intentional violation? So if you look at source 12, so Rabbeinu Nissen says that reason is, it's one thing if I know I'm doing something wrong and I'm not acting according to the law. But it can be, the sages in some contexts consider it even worse that if a person pretends or makes lip service to act within the law and then abuses it. Because ultimately what's going to happen, Rabbeinu Nissim says, that people are going to learn from him, and then this whole law of Erev Tavshilin will be uprooted. Therefore, they made a penalty that he couldn't eat the food. Because if I see that someone does this, everyone will think, I don't need to make an Erev Tavshilin, I'll just do this trick where I can pretend that guests may come. As opposed to someone he knows he forgot to make it one time, so he won't do it again, and we'll allow it to be more lenient. So you see in this context that the trickery, the legal fiction, if you will, is actually treated more harshly than a violation or an ignorance of the law, because it will set a precedent. So with taxes, how do we determine the intent of the law? Meaning a legal fiction is something that's going around the intent of the law. So how do we determine the intent of the law? So the question is, does the government want us to pay more taxes than we need to?
Sometimes the intent of the law comes out through jurisprudence, when we see it going through the courts. Then we see it going through a rigorous process, maybe you have to go up the levels of the courts to see what the spirit in the eyes of the judges are, the tax judges.
Right, because sometimes there's a precedent isn't set, and there has to, in that case, has to be evaluated.
And then maybe later on, the law comes out because the laws can always be made and changed.
Right. Right. That's a good point. That's why this whole idea of a tax avoidance or aggressive tax avoidance has a lot of gray areas. But as for the question of does. Let's say I could potentially pay more if I filled out my taxes one way. If I filled them out another way, all things being equal, does the government want me to pay more? Or on an ethical level, should I pay more? So it seems to be a machlokes, a dispute between Plato and some American politicians of the 20th century. Plato says in verse 13, when there's an income tax, the just men will pay more and the unjust less than the same amount of income. So I don't know what Plato's income was, but he says, as a ethical duty, you should try to pay more. Others say no, that one is not, in source 14, one is not required to arrange his or her affairs so that the government will receive more tax than it's rightfully owed. Nor is it fraudulent, construed an ambiguous law in a manner that is adverse to the government. So no, if the law allows it, according to this approach, it's reasonable to do so. So now when looking at Jewish law with regard to taxes and tithes, so what do we do? How do the rabbis view a situation where someone might potentially have to pay more, but through a certain mechanism is able to pay less? So we only have a few more minutes, so I'll try to go through this rather quickly. So, source 15 deals with tithes. That certain tithes, certain produce that had to be tithed, only became obligated in tithes once it was brought through the entrance of the house. And it learns it from a verse in the Torah, min habayis, that from the house, and learns from there that it has to be the place where people generally enter and exit. So what would people do? It says in source 15, so it says that the earlier and later generations were different. The earlier generations would bring them by way of the main entranceway. They would bring it to the main entranceway so that the produce would be obligated in tithes. They wanted to do the mitzvah, they wanted to pay the tithes. But the later generations would bring in the produce by way of the roofs and by way of the enclosures, you know, basically through the back door, or through a roundabout way, in order to exempt the produce from tithes. So again, it sounds like they're saying that this is a sentiment that the earlier generation was better, that even though true, it wasn't illegal to bring in the produce not through the front entrance, but it says really, I'm going to say a little bit like what Plato said, really if you have the opportunity to pay more, to donate more, so then maybe it seems like it's praiseworthy to do so. And this also seems to portray trying to get around, using mechanisms to get around the law to avoid paying taxes in a negative way. However, other sources seem to indicate otherwise. Look at source 16, the Mishnah, in discussing the secondary tithe. So secondary tithe was in the second, fourth, and fifth year, a person would take, after other taxes, the 10% of their produce to Jerusalem, told Maser Sheni, the 10% of their produce to Jerusalem, and if they couldn't or didn't want to carry it all to Jerusalem, so they would exchange it for the value of the fruit and add a fifth onto it. And then instead of bringing their fruit to Jerusalem, they would bring the money there and spend it. But what would people do if they wanted to avoid, they didn't want to schlep all their fruit to Yerushalayim, and they didn't want to pay the 20% surcharge? So they would tell their adult son or daughter or Jewish servant, here is money, meaning let's say it's worth $100. I'm going to give you $100. Here's $100. Then go and redeem the produce for me. And in that case, through this roundabout mechanism, they wouldn't be liable to the 20% increase. So it was perfectly legal. Again, it was a way of getting around it, but it doesn't even say there was something that was done. The Mishnah actually gives us advice on how to do it. He says, the Mishnah says, Marimin al Maisa Sheni. It tells us, it sounds like something that you don't want people to do, so you're not really going to give them instructions on how to do it. Here it gives you instructions. You know, really you pay the 20% surcharge, but if you do it through this roundabout way, you have your son or daughter do the redemption for you, so then you can get out of the 20%. So why is this not considered, you know, so negative and like we saw before? So the Rambam says that really he addresses the word of harama, which is what the Mishnah uses, marimin, which we've understood as trickery. But the Rambam says also harama could be understood as cleverness, and mirma is trickery or a deception. So really, cleverness may be okay to be clever, but not to be deceptive. So that's where he notices that word of the Mishnah and justifies it on that basis. However, as Jerry alluded to, sometimes the rabbis permitted things which they might not have otherwise, out of a sense of overarching concerns and the overarching good. And I think we can see this this methodology here. The Rav Moshe Sofer says in source 18 that why was this permitted and why was it widespread? Because otherwise, had we not allowed this roundabout way, this harama, this trick of giving the money to the kids and then having them redeem the produce, so what would people have done? They didn't want to pay the 20%. They didn't want to take their fruit to Yerushalayim. So they would have just let it rot. They could have just let their fruit rot, and then it wouldn't be subject to the tithes. And if that happened, not only would there not be fruit in Yerushalayim, the economy wouldn't have been boosted by the fact that people were traveling there and spending there. So because the rabbis wanted to encourage people to support the economy in Yerushalayim, so because of that greater concern, they even allowed this, call it cleverness, this trick of giving the redemption money to the son or daughter and then having them redeem it. And avoiding that 20% tax. And this is this point is echoed by Professor Ephraim Orbach, who explains it like this. They gave the sanction, he says, to the practice of evasion, source 18, was in a sense a takana, a decree to prevent the development of a situation which the people refrained from bringing, similar to, as what Jerry said, the people refrained from lending. That at the realities at the time made it so that if you didn't compromise on the 20% or didn't allow people to circumvent this 20% surcharge, so then people wouldn't bring their produce to Yerushalayim, just like in the case of Prisbel with loans that were canceled during Shemitah. If you didn't create this mechanism, so then people would refrain from loaning. So because of this overarching concern, in those cases, the rabbis were more ready to permit harama, permit trickery or cleverness.
When this happens, does it not imply that human beings, the rabbis, have figured they know human nature better than the Torah did, better than God did? When they say, you know, there's maybe a law of Maser Sheni, whatever Maser you're referring to,
Maser Sheni, yeah.
Human nature isn't going to let it happen properly. It's all going to go bad. We're going to get worse results. So we're going to create the ability to get around it. Isn't that going to imply that God didn't figure out human nature and we have?
So I think that there's the ideal and then there's the realities that develop in certain times. And I think this can be seen from the Gemara in Gittin in source 15, where it said, see the difference between the later generations and the earlier generations. So apparently the earlier generations were more willing to go 100%, but sometimes, as happened, the younger generation isn't as committed. So then the rabbis were willing to employ mechanisms that were found, that were available within the law, to, I guess, really to produce the lesser of two evils, or at least enable the positive result that maybe was the intent of the law. Meaning the intent of the law was that the produce would be brought to Jerusalem or the economy would be boosted. So now that people are reluctant to do that, can we allow this trick to happen in order that the, and I think this goes back to the CRA formulation, in order that the intent of the law could still be accomplished. So as far as the Torah, you know, knowing or not knowing human nature, I think, you know, human nature is sometimes we're more eager to go 100% and sometimes less. And that there are mechanisms available within the Torah to account for those times where people were not as eager to go 100%. So basically, I think that you can try to speak a lot more about this, but we are out of time. But I think when looking at the CRA guidelines, the distinction between tax avoidance and aggressive tax avoidance is whether it's consistent with the intent of the law. Meaning the benefits that the behavior that the government wanted to promote and the reason, serving the basis for the exemption, does that fit within the intent of the law, within the spirit of the law? And I think this applies to the views of using certain exemptions in Jewish law, that in general we're hesitant to do it when it wasn't the intent of that the law was designed, like in the case of the Erev Tavshilin, for example. But sometimes in a case where maybe the sidestepping the law, if you will, better enables the favorable outcome to happen, then maybe we are more willing to allow these methods of avoidance, you know, more than we would otherwise. And as the tax experts, you know, may know, I certainly am not an expert, but how would we apply that to our tax laws? You know, the government wants to support certain behavior, so does that mean that they know they're willing to have some people use tax avoidance to some degree, because overall they want, you know, businesses to thrive and nonprofits to exist and et cetera, et cetera, or not? So I guess that would have to, you have to determine what level of tax avoidance still fits in with the intent of the law, and what goes beyond it.
In that case, it's not avoidance, it's planning, and it's what the government intends. The mention was made of RSPs and TDFSAs. The government also wants you to put money away so that you're not indigent when you're older and they have to take care of you, that you've got a method that's it's not a certain form of avoidance that they're allowing, it's planning that they're allowing within a framework.
Right, for sure. And I guess the question is, what are they willing to, you know, let's say, overlook or accept, even if it may not fit within that ideal? Let's say their ideal is, you know, we want people to be able to put money away and formulate their, let's say, their will in a certain way. But someone uses some mechanism in the system that maybe didn't fit with the original intent. But how much are they willing to accept outside of the ideal because they want the system overall to exist? So I guess that's for the tax lawyers and the accountants. But I think conclude that we, you know, of course, Judaism does recognize an obligation to the countries in which we should live to pay taxes and to contribute to the overall well-being, and that goes without saying that any taxes that we approach all of our taxes and dealings with the utmost honesty and not use ways that we're not allowed to and entitlements that we don't deserve, but you know, work within the system and with experts to be able to fill out our taxes honestly, but also hopefully favorably for us. And I guess this tax season is coming, so I guess a bracha that we should all have favorable taxes.
Square.
Thank you so much.
Just before
we end, I noted in the beginning, if your username doesn't identify you by name and you're not on our email list for this, please make sure to sign in the chat with your email address just so we can give you credit. Yep.
How do you does halakha approach the issue of our current system of taxation, which is progressive? It means the more money you make, not only are you paying more taxes, but you're paying at a higher rate, vis-a-vis what is essentially in the halakha, either a flat amount like the chatziah shekel, or the various forms of trumas and maestros that we have that are fixed percentage.
Right. So I think I didn't look into it as much, but as you mentioned, that a lot of the taxes are mostly fixed percentages. But I think an argument could be made that if the idea of taxes are to provide for the common good, so maybe people who are in a greater position to do so, maybe it would be justified for them to have to pay more. Right. I'm just thinking about it. I think taxes, to some extent, are how we relate to them are intertwined. Meaning, if we view the taxes as you saw by Rabbi Shekhar, as like a partnership, so then in that system, it might be legitimate that those who are in a better position to contribute to it would have to contribute more. But as you said, I think that the standard taxes on the books, you know, the truma, maser, which are by percentages, or chatziah shekel, which are taken equally across the board. I don't think the standard, you know, taxes are progressive. I mean, they're basically just percentages. But I'm saying I don't think that necessarily means that Judaism would not accept or maybe would accept a progressive tax system, you know, if it accomplished other goals.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the share as well.
Thank you.